Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at the time, at the world of economics and politics. We've got two guests lined up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Gary Rivlin, who is the author of the new book, Broke USA, all about the business of making money from the working poor, pawn shops, payday lenders, tax preparers. You may have wondered why what Jackson Hewitt and Liberty Tax Service are all about. We'll talk to Gary Rivlin about that in just a little bit. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Sarah Ellison, who is the author of War at the Wall Street Journal, the story of Rupert Murdoch's takeover of that august publication and what the outcome of that has been. Before all that, I do want to thank those of you who pledged during our recent fund drive. If you did make that pledge, please do send in your contribution. And if you didn't make a pledge during the fund drive, it's never too late to visit our website, wbai.org, and hit the donate button. But thanks to all of those of you who did pledge and contribute and made it a success. Well, it's nice to see the U.S. government taking a tougher line against BP, at least rhetorically. Imagine the stockholders having to forego a full year's worth of dividends. Sacrifices all around. We will see what this $20 billion escrow fund that BP has promised to create actually works out to be. It's certainly not 20 gigalarge all at once, that's for sure. We'll see what happens as the contributions are supposed to be forthcoming from BP. They've got the money. Let's see if they've got the will, and the government has the will, to make sure it keeps coming. It's also nice to see oil executives getting raked over the coals, at least, again, rhetorically. We'll see what actually comes of this populist moment, given the centrality of oil to our economic life and of oil money to our politics. I'm skeptical that the outcome will amount to much. Nice as well to see the president, amidst all his invocations of deity in his speech the other night, try to use this horror show in the Gulf of Mexico to promote cleaner energy. But he certainly made his contribution earlier on to offshore drilling, at least until it became politically insupportable the day before yesterday. And in no small part, by promoting the rhetoric of energy independence, which is a very toxic thing. The test shouldn't be where in the world our energy comes from, but whether the use of it makes our world a lesser or dirtier place. And there seems to be niceness all around. It was nice to see the New York Times give front page attention to Nigeria, a country that has experienced the equivalent of an Exxon Valdez accident every year for the past 50. Where the country has seen little from the oil extracted from its soil except a residue of toxic filth. Nigeria provides about 10% of our oil, a bit more than does the Gulf of Mexico, but we give it very little thought. More on all this in the coming weeks. In more mundane news of the economic cycle, the strength of the first quarter looks to be yielding to a weaker second quarter. First-time claims for unemployment insurance rose by 12,000 last week, following a 1,000 increase the previous week. Those aren't big numbers on the upside, but claims should be falling now, not rising, if the job market were really healing. The National Association of Home Builders' monthly sentiment index fell sharply for this month, undoing a recovery it had seen in April and May. The Mortgage Bankers Association's purchase index, which measures buyers' applications for new loans, eked out a gain last week following a month of sharp losses. All this suggests that fears that the housing recovery couldn't survive the expiration of the first-time buyer's federal tax credit in April, these worries were not misplaced. And looking ahead, the Conference Board's leading index, designed to forecast moves in the broad economy 3 to 6 months out, rose modestly in May. Its behavior in recent months suggests that the recovery will continue, but at a slower pace, which sounds like a reasonable forecast to me. George Soros, among others, attracted some attention recently, projecting a so-called double-dip recession, that is, another leg down in the major economic indicators in the coming months. While everything Soros says should be taken with a grain of salt, he's a master trader, and traders are famous for, as they say, talking their book, meaning uttering pronouncements in line with their current financial holdings. Soros is no dope, and he should be at least listened to. But my guess is that we won't see another leg down, just a long, wrenching period of slow growth and persistently high unemployment. Yippee. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about making money off poverty.
Have we got a reason to celebrate? Another cocktail, rib on me. Everything's going our way. Oh, everything's going our way. The ice has been scattered, the corner smashed. This government has done all right by us. They don't say that you sink or you swim. Either you sink or you swim. Well,
that was some of the Merchant Banker's Drinking Song by the band McCarthy from the early 1990s. We're now joined in the studio by Gary Rivlin, who is the author of many books, most recently Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business, just published by Harper. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
So the time was when poor folks really couldn't get a loan. Redlining banks, famously redlined neighborhoods, literally drew red lines around them saying no loans in this neighborhood. We've got a new meaning of redlining now, don't we?
And the shock of this project is we now have a concept called reverse redlining. So how did businesses react to doing virtually no lending in the inner city and other working class enclaves? They just drown these communities in a destructive form of debt to just increase the odds that these people would end up in financial ruin. And, you know, everything from the payday lenders to, you know, some of these really odd creative products, the auto title loan. I mean, that was some of the challenge in this book, is there's just so many ways that entrepreneurs have come up with to get rich off the working poor.
Well, how did this really get started? People have been making money off lending money to poor people for a long time, but it really became big business when?
It was about 25 years ago. You're right. I mean, pawn shops have been with us for, you know, centuries. Check cashing goes back to the 1930s. But what we saw happening is some entrepreneurs, some businesses figured that they can get a lot of these stores and make it into a really big business. So some of these old line companies I'm talking about went to Wall Street, and today there's six publicly traded companies in the check cashing business, or seven if you include Walmart, which entered a few years back. Pawn shops, the same thing. There's three publicly traded companies. That all started in the mid-'80s, early 90s, but even more than these businesses that would have been with us for a long time changing, becoming more corporate. There was a slew of these newer businesses, the pioneers of subprime, you could call them. These people came up with the payday loan, which started in 1993, the instant tax refund. You mentioned Jackson Hewitt, Liberty. H&R Block is actually really big in that business too. That was the late 80s, early 90s. So we really, in the 90s, saw the working poor become big business, huge Wall Street paying attention business.
I mentioned Jackson Hewitt and Liberty because I never really thought about them until I moved to Brooklyn a couple of years ago. When I was living in Manhattan, you didn't see them. I mean, H&R Block, household name, but unless you frequent certain neighborhoods in this country, you don't run into them in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I mean, that's at least maybe I missed something, but I didn't notice them there. Before we move on, you did mention Walmart. I wanted to ask this question while I had it in mind. These businesses seem like a natural for Walmart. Certainly their customers are major patrons of these sorts of lending operations. Why hasn't Walmart really gotten to this in a big way? Do you have any idea?
No, I don't know, but they're now starting to get big in the debit card business, the check cashing business. It's funny. I've been debating in my head, is this a good thing or a bad thing that Walmart's moving into this? I mean, Walmart being Walmart, they come in and they cut the prices on everyone. So instead of paying 2, 3, 4, 5% of the face value of a payroll check, depending on the state you live in, Walmart will charge you only a few bucks. And I kind of think it's a good thing. I mean, I think the goal here is, can we at least, with a check cashing operation, could we at least make this a little bit more affordable? One of the things I find astounding is one-third of the states in this country have no limit on the amount of money that a check casher could charge to cash a check. Here in New York, you could charge just under 2% of a payroll check. So if someone makes $20,000, that's like a $400 a year poverty tax. You don't have a checking account, it's going to cost you an extra $400. You live in Georgia, you live in other places in the South, it's 5%. And suddenly that's $1,000 out of your $20,000 that you're paying. But there's some states where it's just the sky is the limit. So Walmart coming in and putting price pressure on it, I just have to think, is a good thing.
Well, if you go into a deli and withdraw money from an ATM, you're paying, you know, $2 on what could be a $40 withdrawal, $20 withdrawal even. So even if you got a bank account, you can get screwed by these little charges here and there.
Banks are good at that. They figured out lots of ways.
Yeah.
I think it's $20 billion they get from bounce check fees, some astonishingly high number like that.
And as those fees have gone up, it's been a big gain for a lot of these operators you write about, isn't it?
That the payday lending industry, in a way, started once the cost of a bounce check became so high that there was ostensibly an economic advantage to taking out a payday loan.
Now, describe a payday loan. A lot of people may not know what those are.
Sure. Actually, it's only in around operates in only around two-thirds of the state, not here in New York, not in New Jersey or Connecticut. The payday lender is like an emergency banker for the working poor. You need a checking account and a regular check, paycheck, a government check, your Social Security, something like that. And it's a loan against your next check. So it's a two-week loan in an emergency when you need it against your paycheck.
And you write a post-dated check and leave it with the
It's a risky proposition for these businesses. About 5% of the people, the checks aren't good. I mean, there's no collateral except for your promise in 2 weeks that this loan would be good. But with that said, I wouldn't feel too sorry for the payday lenders. They're just rolling tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, some of these operations are making in a year.
So who are the entrepreneurial geniuses who invented the payday loan?
Well, the father of the modern day payday loan industry is this guy named Alan Jones, who lives in Cleveland, Tennessee. Inherited a debt collection business from his dad, was building it into this huge operation, offices all around Tennessee. When he just happened to stumble on this guy informally making these cash advances against people's next paycheck, and the light bulb went off, and he now has a chain of about 1,200 of these stores, and he's getting post-tax profits of about $23 million a year. And it was interesting because this is a really fun book to write, to hang out with these pioneers. They're interesting characters. They invited me to spend time with them.
A lot of these guys didn't come out of Wharton.
One or two. Most of them.
They later made connections with people who did.
Exactly. You exactly took the words. Because one thing that's interesting is this might have started with a lot of bootstrapping entrepreneurs, but let's not pretend this is just kind of a purely entrepreneurial thing. I mean, just to list the names of the banks that have helped fund the growth of this industry. It's now a $40 billion a year industry. Wachovia, Nations Bank, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo. I mean, this business got really, really big because of the MBAs from Wharton or Harvard or wherever.
Yeah, you describe a situation where a lot of the name brand banks left neighborhoods and got replaced by subsidiaries who are either off-brand.
This was another shock and infuriating once you learn it of this project, is that I thought that the big brand name banks fled the working class communities if they were ever there in the first place. And it's not really that simple. They closed down the name brands, the Wells Fargo, the Citibank, and then they came in with these off-brands that were subprime lenders. So with Citibank, it's City Financial. So if you go to the Citibank lender and you want to refinance your home, you want a home equity loan, you get a 6, 7, 8%, whatever the going rate is. If you go to City Financial, it starts at 10, 12% the rate. So there was really almost like two doors. And it was just in your neighborhood. If you were in a neighborhood where there was a City Financial or the off-brand for a Wells Fargo or wherever, you weren't even given the option of a conventional rate loan. And one of the great underreported tragedies of the subprime meltdown is, according to the Federal Reserve, according to Fannie Mae, 50% of the people who got a subprime loan actually qualified for a conventional rate loan. And, you know, if you're paying 6%, if you're paying 9% on a $200,000 loan versus 6% on a $200,000 loan, that's an extra $400 a month. The Wall Street Journal did a study, and they said it was 60% were steered into more expensive subprime loans because mortgage brokers were given these bribes, essentially, a yield spread premium, but it's just a fancy word for a payment, to put somebody into a higher price loan than they otherwise qualified. And it's a huge racial element, too. If you were lived in a predominantly black community, according to a HUD study, you were five times more likely to be put into a subprime mortgage loan than if you lived in a predominantly white community. And then they broke it down by people making over $100,000, African-Americans making over $100,000 a year. They were still twice as likely to be put in a subprime loan as a moderate-income white.
The subprime businesses made this world world-renowned, this business of lending to supposedly poor credit risks. To some degree, that business was pioneered by community groups who are trying to do good things for their poorer clients. Talk about their pioneering work in the subprime field.
You know, there's this canard out there. Turn on Fox News. You can hear it. The poor are to blame for the subprime.
Yes, I noticed you quote the annoying Neil Cavuto.
Yeah, he famously said that on TV. And, you know, but it's not just him. You read the Washington Times. I suppose Rush Limbaugh said it. I didn't hear him say it. I'd be shocked if he didn't. This just underscores the difference between responsible lending, ethical lending, and what went on in subprime, which was predatory subprime lending. So Martin Eakes, one of the main characters in the book, since the mid-1980s, he's been making home loans expressly to people of modest means. And he has an astonishing record. He charges about 1% above the conventional rate versus these more predatory subprime lenders who are charging 5, 6, 7, 8% above the conventional rate mortgage. And in his first 10 years, nearly half his customers were single moms. Nearly half his credit union's customers were people of color. And he had three defaults during that 10-year period. I mean, what he did versus the more predatory incarnations of the subprime mortgage lenders is he put people in houses that they could afford. If you make $20,000, $30,000 a year, you can afford a house that costs $50,000 or $60,000. He didn't hit you with all these upfront fees. It costs about 1% of the loan in upfront fees versus what you saw going on with some of these subprime mortgage lenders, other subprime mortgage lenders, where they were charging upfront fees typically of 8%, 10%. I saw some that were 20%. You don't even give people a fighting chance to pay off the loan when you charge them interest rates 5, 6, 7, 8% higher than the going rate, and you hit them with all these upfront fees.
Yeah, it's not just the fees. Then there was a credit insurance, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, credit life insurance. I mean, there are two products that subprime mortgage loans tended to have that weren't in conventional loans. One is a prepayment penalty. Come the late 1990s, the middle class customers were just not accepting prepayment penalties. It's like a 5% penalty if you want to refinance within the first 5 years. That was a typical rate. But they were in the majority of subprime loans. And the other one was credit life insurance. And in fact, it would be packaged. So you'd pay the whole cost up front. So you'd be paying financing charges on it. I write about this one couple from Dayton, Ohio. They didn't even realize they were buying credit life insurance. The salespeople are very good at selling it to you without realizing you're buying it. It just sounds like it's a warranty. It's the kind of thing that comes with you. It added $7,500 to the amount they were borrowing, and their loan had a 13.9% interest rate on it. I did the math on that. That's more than $30,000 for this credit life insurance that, you know, if you were paying it by the year, by the month, the way most of us pay insurance, it would have come out to $7,500. It was the kind of ripoffs that went on among those living on the economic fringes that did not go on with more prosperous customers.
Speaking with Gary Rivlin, who is the author of Broke USA, just out from Harper. Of course, the guys who are selling these loan products were not above lying about interest rates. You read about one guy who thought he was getting 7.2 and he was actually paying much higher than that.
Right? That's the couple I was just talking about. You know, they were told, you know, I mean, this is a typical case. Let's name names. Household Finance. Household Finance, huge publicly traded company, was sold for like $15, $16 billion in 2002, 2003. They would go through records to find out who owed a lot of credit card debt, who was carrying a lot of credit card debt, and owned equity in a home. And then they would just call and call and call and call to try to get those people to refinance. So Tommy and Marsha Myers, this couple I'm writing about, they're just hearing, you know, he's always calling. And it turns out that Marsha Myers, she's a school cafeteria worker, got sick. And they racked up about 10 grand in credit card debts. She was out of work for a year. They decide maybe it makes sense to refinance. The guy promised them a 7.2% interest rate. They had good credit, the Myers. And it sounded like a really good deal. It turns out that it was a 13.9% interest rate and all these hidden fees, 8% in upfront fees, the $7,500 credit life insurance I'm talking about. And, you know, they went from owning this nice, modest $60,000 home in Dayton, Ohio, to within 6 months, just bankrupt.
Now, were the guys pushing these loans, were they looking for that result? Did they want to take over the house and then flip it? Or were they really just hoping to get that, the debt serviced, and make oodles of money that way?
Well, you know, there's almost different waves of subprime mortgage lending. As you mentioned, subprime mortgage lending started in the early 1980s in the inner cities. At first, it was just fly-by-night lenders, but then the big banks saw the kind of money they could make. And it was invariably people of color or in rural areas. And the game then was to flip people. I mean, this famously, it was put on page one of the Wall Street Journal in the late 1990s. Famously, Benny Roberts, a quarry worker, a retired quarry worker, living on $850 in Social Security. This lender, infamous lender, Associates, owned by Ford Motor, Associates flips him 10 times in 4 years, racking up $19,000 in extra fees on a loan that started off as a $1,200, $1,300 home equity loan. So that was the game back then. You just flip and flip and flip people. Another term is packing. You pack it with all these extra fees, and then there's equity stripping. Keep collecting the money while the people are able to pay it. And if they can't pay it, well, the loan is secured with a house. So they'll just take the house. And, you know, I think one of the things that's misunderstood about subprime is 80% of subprime loans were refinancing. So there's there's the couple that bought a $600,000 house on a salary good for a home half that size. And, you know, we could talk about how irresponsible that might have been. But most of it, the majority of it, 80% of it, was refinancing. And that, to me, is the infuriating part, because you had a lot of people in, like the couple, the Myers from Dayton, who were in conventional rate loans and got hoodwinked. They got convinced. They were not financially savvy. And they got convinced to go into a subprime loan and ended up losing the home, losing the equity that they had already built up.
And there's also this gimmick that the peddlers of these things use, which is walking around, knocking on doors, saying, "I see you need some work in your roof," right?
Yeah, again, I hear the arguments about, well, aren't the people who took these loans to blame? And yeah, sure, once this spreads to the middle class and there are all these people using their homes as an ATM to go to Europe or build a second bathroom, that's one thing. But the way this began was these home repair guys going door to door, like out of the movie Tin Man, and knocking on the doors of little old ladies, and driving them to the mortgage broker and putting them into these horrendous loans with interest rates of 20, 25%, with upfront fees of 10, 15, 20%. And so many of these people just ended up losing their homes. There was a Senate hearing in 1998 about equity stripping. And a former salesman for a few of these lenders testified that the ideal customer, he was taught, was an unsophisticated older woman living on a fixed income, preferably from pension or Social Security from her dead husband, who's carrying a lot of debt or had some kind of physical problem in their house, a roof was leaking or such. And that is who they targeted. I mean, this was clearly predatory. It might have turned into something else once it, in 2000, AmeriQuest, New Century, Countrywide came along, but not these early waves.
And, you know, reading this and thinking about it, I always wonder, how do these guys live with themselves? So how did they live with themselves?
Well, I mean, in a way, that's the question of the book. I wanted to find out, you know, who wakes up one day and says, huh, I know how I want to make my millions. I want to get rich off the, you know, mom with two kids working as a chambermaid at the Holiday Inn.
And I want to hoodwink her because she doesn't really understand thick financial documents.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, instead of taking $1,000 out of her $20,000 a year paycheck, I want to take $2,000 out of her $20,000 paycheck. Maximizing share of wallet. That's a term I learned while researching this book. But there generally wasn't. I spent a lot of time with these guys, and there wasn't a defensiveness. You see, they see themselves as noble. They're providing emergency loans to those who otherwise have no alternative. So I try to engage them in what's too much? How do you justify this? And the conversation with most was a non-starter, because as far as they were concerned, they were intrepid. They were in communities where the other lenders didn't dare to go.
Yep, they were like doing a public service.
Exactly.
And they would adopt a populist rhetoric. You know, the pinstripe guys wouldn't deal with these folks. So here I am, the savior of the...
A public service, I'll point out that on a payday loan, you know, the fee is typically $15 for every $100 borrowed. That works out to an annual interest rate of 390%. If you're unlucky enough to live in Missouri, where they could charge $22.50 per $100, that's a 650% annual interest rate. So it's a funny version of public service.
Which, of course, at one point these interest rates were illegal, but starting in the early 1980s, that ceased to be the case.
So much of this is growing out of deregulation. In the 1980s, the federal government deregulated home loans, and that just opened the floodgates for subprime lenders. With the payday lenders, it was different. Most states have a usury cap, a law that says you can't charge more than 28-36%, depending on the state, in interest. And what the payday lenders did is they spent a lot of money on campaign contributions and lobbyists, trying to convince state legislatures to exempt them from the existing usury law. And their logic was, well, these are two-week loans, and they're fees, it's not really annual interest rates. And there was a persuasive argument in several dozen states, not here in New York, not in other states, but it worked. And so they were granted exemptions from existing laws. And in fact, the federal government, there's legislation, it's never gotten anywhere. But in the last few years, there's been bills proposed to have a national usury cap of typical number is 36%, and, you know, may happen, but who knows?
Yeah, but that still would be a Tony Soprano level of interest rate.
Actually, it's funny you should say that, because I had to know this. I just had to know this. So I found a loan shark, and, you know, what do you charge? I asked, and, you know, it's like loan shark typically charges 2 or 3 points a week, and that works out to an annual interest rate of 150%. So in fairness, the
36 is reasonable next to that.
Yes.
Just only got a minute or so left, but what has the Great Recession done to this business?
You know, boom times. I mean, this is just an upside down world where no money in your pocket is good for business. So you look at the pawnbroker stocks, and they're up 50% over the last couple of years. Hasn't been the best couple of years for the stock market.
So I guess a lot of formerly middle-class people taking advantage of, what's the word, alternative financial?
Specialty financing.
Specialty
too.
Financing.
I learned a lot of euphemisms. Yeah. In fact, the pawnbrokers talk about that, all these flat-screen TVs being pawned. The payday lenders, their stocks are down because there's potentially this federal cap, so they might be, you know, legislated out of existence. But their per-store revenues are up. I mean, they're doing very well, too. I mean, there's an expression I love that a banker wants 100 people worth at least $1 million. Payday lenders, pawnbrokers, they want 1 million people, none of whom have $100 in their pocket.
Yeah, you quote somebody as saying, you know, this business is recession-proof because there's always 100 people who need $100 in a hurry.
Exactly. I mean, I'd rather be in the poverty business right now than in the luxury good business.
Oh, well, luxury is coming back in the last couple of months. The irrepressible American desire for aspiration. Okay, we're out of time. I've been speaking with Gary Rivlin, who is the author of Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business, a fine book about a very depressing subject. You kept your good cheer in the course of researching and writing this. All right, thanks for joining us, Gary Rivlin, and we'll be back after a musical break to talk about the other end of things at the Wall Street Journal.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
That was a bit of the first movement of Haydn's Piano Sonata number 35, performed by, my Hungarian is very rusty, but I think Jéno Jandó, perhaps? Very fine, complete set of the Haydn Piano Sonatas performed by him. Oh, yeah, I should say, this is not only WBAI 99.5 in your FM dial in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you do visit the website, hit the donate button. We could always use your help. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. We're now joined in the studio by Sarah Ellison, who is the author of War at the Wall Street Journal, Inside the Struggle to Control an American Business Empire, just out from Houghton Mifflin. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
I think you're a little far away from the microphone there.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, that's good. That's much better.
Okay.
Before we start, I think there might be quite a few people in the audience who might not be fans of the Wall Street Journal, might think it was just a business rag. Actually, I know my friends at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting thought about commenting on the Murdoch-Turk takeover and then decided it just wasn't worth the effort because it was just a tool of the business elite. That was not the Wall Street Journal of old, right?
Well, that wasn't the Wall Street Journal as I saw it when I was working there, and I was there for 10 years. In fact, my impression of the journal, and I think it was Ralph Nader who said that the journal was the best muckraking newspaper in the country about corporate America. So I think that the editorial page has always been very conservative, and a lot of people associate the paper with that editorial page, but the news pages were always pretty down the middle and quite hard-hitting on the businesses that they reported on. And in fact, I always saw the journal as sort of a watchdog on corporate America.
Yeah, I thought a lot of the stories in page one, well, I thought page one used to be a daily masterpiece, just a wonderful thing. Very old-fashioned, but a very wonderful thing.
And the front page was always filled with these very in-depth stories about American business.
Not just American business, about American society. I thought there's a lot of examination of very complicated things done at a very high level and very well written. And I I miss the old journal, I have to say. I always wondered how long it could have lasted. It was going to last, but now we have our answer. But it was a great paper in the old days. But it was also, the culture was kind of stodgy. It was not really part of the New York media elite, was it?
Exactly. I mean, the journal, it was always, the headquarters was always in New York, but it was always of the Midwest in a certain way. A lot of the big editors and the early talent that made the journal what it is today, notably Barney Kalame, who was sort of the legendary editor of the journal, that turned it from a very narrow investment paper into the sort of nation's business paper, was from the Midwest and always had this sort of hardworking, nose to the grindstone kind of mentality. And people in New York, I mean, the investment community read the journal, and people in sort of flyover country read the journal. But here in the city, people, for the most part, read the New York Times as their local newspaper, and they're very loyal to that. But the journal, as it was for a long time, really occupied a space outside of that kind of cultural idea, and people in the city and in sort of the media elite in New York really didn't associate with it very much.
And I recall the early 90s when Norman Perlstein was running the thing.
Right.
I wrote a piece which earned me my best review ever. Norm Perlstein told me I was scum, sick and twisted, and it was tragic that I exist.
Really?
The greatest moment of my career as a journalist. But people were scandalized then that Norm was like, had married Nancy Friday and was going to fancy parties and hanging out with the glitterati. And
I suppose for that time, you know, it was glitzier than what people were used to.
But that old culture of the journal really kind of resisted what he was up to and succeeded in preserving itself for a little while longer. But talk a bit about the family that owned Dow Jones, and that the family ownership was a lot of what protected the journal from the modern competitive media world, right?
Exactly. So the journal for 105 years before it was owned, before it was bought by Rupert Murdoch, it was owned by a sort of Boston-based family called the Bancroft family. And they were originally from Boston, but they had, over the generation, sort of spread out all over the country and become quite separate from the paper that they controlled and that they had once owned. So they were always discouraged from being involved in the business of the paper or the editorial side of the paper. From a very early point in the family's history, they were told to, quote-unquote, leave it to the professionals, and that meant leaving the journalism to the journalism professionals and leaving the business to the business professionals. So in theory, that was supposed to allow this institution to flourish without any kind of meddling, and it did that. But what it also did was it created an incredibly strained relationship between the family and the paper and institution that they controlled. And so when it came time to try to grapple with what to do with the journal and with Dow Jones in this incredibly fast-changing media environment, they were really flummoxed with what they could do. They had a CEO, Peter Kahn, who had been CEO for a very long time, that a lot of the people in the family were unhappy with, but they didn't really know how to change that.
Why were they unhappy with Kahn?
I think it was because the company wasn't performing particularly well and didn't perform particularly well under his...
And the family lived in the dividends of Dow Jones stock?
Exactly. I mean, the family relied on very generous dividends from Dow Jones. And while the business was good, that was great. And then when the stock just started to decline, they blamed the management, as they probably well should have. But it was the kind of thing that the management didn't totally know exactly what the family wanted, and the family didn't really totally trust the management. And because there was no interaction between the two, any real interaction between the two, I think that was sort of the seeds of the downfall, in fact.
And Kahn, although he was a business on the business side, actually came up through the journalism ranks and was held in high regard by a lot of reporters around the journal.
No question. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and he was a beautiful, beautiful writer and an incredible and talented journalist. I mean, he told me at one point that he thought that he wasn't he was a better businessman than what people thought, and he probably wasn't as good a journalist as what people thought. But I think that the lore of Peter Kahn is that he was this genius, gifted journalist and a terrible businessman.
Well, it's funny, you just said beautiful writer, and I remember when I was doing my research for my own piece almost 20 years ago now about Dow Jones under Norm Perlstein, or Wall Street Journal under Perlstein. People then would refer to reporters as beautiful writers, too. That's not something you associate with the culture of a newspaper. I mean, newspapers are all about breaking news and, at least in the old days, kind of a crude and rough approach to writing. Just get the facts out.
Right.
Pound
exactly.
it out. But that's not the way the journal was produced.
No,
was it?
The journal really saw itself. It was sort of this, I described, you know, some of your listeners will remember the old appearance of the journal, which was very vertical. It was all in columns down the front page.
And no photos.
There were these sort of famous dot drawings of CEOs' heads and things like that. But I describe in the book that the columns were like, you know, these beautiful Corinthian columns down the front of the paper, and they were sort of treated in that way. The front page was treated in that way, that you wouldn't
besmirch it. And then the funny story down the center.
I mean, these are all the things that people were very loyal to and really loved about the paper. Of course, you know, holding something in amber and preserving it in that way forever was always going to be impossible. And so now we see, you know, Murdoch had his eye on the journal for years and years, and he has now taken it and really recreated it in the image that he wants. And it's much more of a sort of banner headline, sort of Fleet Street style, sort of London style newspaper, where there are lots of big pictures, lots of big headlines. It's much more a sort of it's not the kind of analytical sort of sit back and have these long pieces on the front page that are sort of meditations on things. There, it's very much, as you describe, kind of get the facts out, and the headlines are incredibly direct, so you know exactly what people are trying to say.
The headlines now sound a lot like the Financial Times, I guess, that shows the Thompson pedigree. I was speaking with Sarah Ellison, who is author of War at the Wall Street Journal, just out from Houghton Mifflin. What years were you at the Journal?
I was at the Journal from 98 to 2009.
So you were there as the newspaper industry was crashing and burning.
Exactly.
So before Rupert arrived at the scene, what was the talk inside the Journal? How were we going to cope with this new media environment?
Well, interestingly, a few years before Rupert Murdoch came on the scene, Dow Jones, Peter Kahn retired after quite a long time as CEO, after 40 years at Dow Jones. And Rich Zannino was the new CEO that was put in his place. And Rich Zannino, unlike...
Is he the guy who came out of Liz Claiborne?
Exactly. Yeah. So he was sort of a finance executive that had worked in at Saks Fifth Avenue and at Liz Claiborne, and for actually some of Warren Buffett's operations. He was a good financial, very good financial guy, but he did not have, unlike almost every CEO that had come up, at Dow Jones, he didn't have a journalism background. And that was seen as a huge break and a huge recognition at Dow Jones that something needed to be done with the business, because you couldn't rely on journalists to really fix this problem. And so when Zannino came along, there were murmurs that he was brought in to sell the company. There, people were very skeptical about what he was going to do with the paper. And he... In the end, did end up selling the company. I don't believe that was exactly what he was sort of brought in to do, but certainly from his perspective, when Rupert Murdoch came along and offered $60 a share, which was an enormous premium over where the stock was trading at the time, it was in its mid-30s, and no one saw exactly how that was going to, it was going to rise much more than that. For someone like Rich Zannino, who really believes in shareholder value and things like that, that weren't really near and dear to the hearts of a lot of the journalists who had run the company before then, it was sort of a no-brainer what he was going to do.
Murdoch had been coveting the Wall Street Journal for a long time.
Right.
Why exactly? What was his hope for it?
Well, I think that, you know, one of his aides once said to me that one of the unhappiest years in his life were when he lived in a city where he didn't own a newspaper. And of course, he's owned the New York Post in New York for a long time, but he always looked at the Journal and at the New York Times as sort of the pinnacle of being a newspaper proprietor, and being a newspaper owner was something the love of that was something that he had inherited from his father, who died unexpectedly at a very young age.
So even somebody as vulgar as Rupert Murdoch wants to be respectable in the end, right?
I think he does, and I think it's funny. He's obviously the media properties that he owns and that he promotes, the ones that he's most known for being Fox. Here in this country, it's by far Fox. And then at the Sun tabloid in London, he introduced topless Page Three girls. And, you know, he's definitely someone who doesn't elevate the properties that he owns.
He's not known for that.
No, he's not known for that. But he does have a love of the news and a love of newspapers for the kind of dialogue they have with politicians and the dialogue they have with big business. And of course, the knock on him is that he just wants the papers so that he can manipulate the news and manipulate the politicians. And but I think that the answer to why he wanted to own the Wall Street Journal is fairly simple. It's the most powerful business newspaper in the most powerful economy in the world. And for somebody who's interested in being in that discussion and at that table, it's for him something that makes perfect sense for why he would want to be there. And he's one of the last people that wants to be there. I mean, there aren't any rich people left who really want to own newspapers. It's not a very good business anymore. So you have to want it for something other than the dividend you're going to get out of the business.
Well, I have to admit that for somebody of my politics and sensibility, I will admit to a scandalous admiration for Rupert Murdoch in some sense. The guy is an evil genius in a lot of ways, and sometimes you just have to stand back and admire his accomplishments in some perverse way. How did he win over the Bancroft family? Was it just money?
In the end, yes. But what he engaged in, and one of the things that I loved reporting on in the book, was he had such an incredible sort of spy network to know what was going on inside the Bancroft family. The Bancroft family was made up of 35 different adult members, and the cousins were
not all of whom liked each other very much.
Exactly. They didn't. You know, there's three branches. There were cousins who were fighting with each other, resentments that had built up over a long period of time. And Murdoch did a lot of research, and he knew someone, in fact, someone who he was sort of contracted to work with him for the deal, had been on a symphony board with one of the cousins. And so we got a lot of information from him. And then he visited, he had sort of had spies everywhere. He also had the main trustee, the main lawyer for the family, was someone who Murdoch had one of his people calling that lawyer every day to get little clues about how the family was feeling, what they were doing. And then he himself really spent a lot of time with the Dow Jones CEO, Rich Zannino. And so what he was able to do was sort of triangulate through all these different sources of information exactly where the weaknesses were. And he had some sources inside the Journal newsroom at a high level. And so he was using all of that in order to kind of gauge what his next move should be. And in fact, his first move was his last move, which was to offer $60 a share to the family. But what he also managed to do during the only other thing that he did that was of any significance.
And it had been trading, what, around 35 or 40?
Yeah, it had been trading at around 35.
Yeah. And so that's a very substantial premium.
It was something like 76% premium over where it had been trading. What he did agree to, in addition to the $60 a share, and this was the thing that the Bancroft family, that really convinced them to sell the paper, was he agreed to an editorial independence proposal that was sort of a contract.
Which he also has at the Times of London.
He has at the Times of London, exactly. He proposed something sort of exactly along the lines of what he had done at the Times of London, which was to set up an independent board that would make sure that he as an owner didn't interfere with the news coverage of the paper. And of course, the Times of London situation is famous for that about a year after he took over that paper, Harry Evans, a very well-respected editor, walked out.
Mr.
Fired.
Tina Brown. Right?
Exactly. Known best in this country as Mr. Tina Brown. He left, and Murdoch reportedly said, that this agreement isn't worth the paper it's written on. And despite that experience, and despite everything that the Bancrofts knew about his track record with these kind of agreements, they signed on and sort of believed, or at least had an enormous capacity for self-deception, that this was going to work.
A 76% premium can
help
turn the mind around.
In that regard,
yes.
Exactly. It can sort of get you over the line. I mean, at the time, people were saying, oh, this is just a fig leaf. But it was the reason that it was important is because the Bancrofts gave up all of their negotiating leverage by negotiating over this agreement in terms of they didn't ask for a penny more than $60 a share. They really used all of their negotiating power to get the strongest agreement that they could get. And if they were really clear-sighted about it, they probably would have recognized that that wasn't worth it at all. That all if they were going to sell the paper, they should have gotten every last penny out of Murdoch that they could have.
So now Murdoch owns the paper. What's he done to it?
Well, when you talk about, you know, you have to have a grudging respect for him, even if you don't agree with his politics, I completely agree with that. I think that he has transformed an institution in with such speed that it's kind of astonishing. He met, you know, a lot of people left the paper. He sort of course, he after this editorial independence agreement, he asked the existing editor to step down 4 months after he had taken over the paper. So he put in his own editor, and he really transformed that front page that we were talking about, so that now the front page of the journal is totally unrecognizable from what it once was. And the kind of stories that they're doing are quite different as well. And what's interesting to me, you have to give, you know, I loved the old journal as it was, but I have to say that during the BP spill coverage, I think the journal's actually had pretty good coverage. So the kind of coverage they're doing, which is just sort of, to borrow an old Howell Raines term, to sort of flood the zone and really go after a story in this very aggressive way, they're doing that now in a way that the journal never used to do. I mean, they would not, they weren't focused on breaking news, and now the journal's really focused on breaking news. He's politicized the paper to a much greater degree in terms of adding a lot of political reporters and really focusing on Washington coverage. I think that the Obama administration is much more aware of the journal now as a presence than it would have been under the old ownership.
Another confession, I sort of know and actually rather like Robert Thompson, the man he brought in to edit the thing. So I've just sort of been very curious watching the transformations of the journal under his editorship.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a hint of some right-wing politics creeping into the paper, isn't there?
Well, it's interesting because certainly, so Murdoch bought the paper in 2007. It actually closed at the very end of 2007. And then the next story that really everyone was focusing on was the presidential election. Of course, that's a political story. And then there was the financial meltdown and financial regulatory reform. There was health care reform. All these stories in this incredibly politicized environment were covered by the journal, I think, in a fairly political way. You saw the language that they were using to describe things like death taxes ended up in the Wall Street Journal. It's a pretty charged term, and that's the kind of thing that never would have made it past the sort of old watchdogs.
Yeah. A friend of mine just did a paper on examining coverage of the stimulus program that the Obama administration produced, and found the journal's language to be very critical in the news pages,
right?
Which the old journal would not have done.
No, I mean, the old journal was very understated in its language, and I think that was part, and it was pretty deferent to the businesses that it covered in the language that it used, but if it was going to criticize them, it was very, very careful about the way that it did that. And it's a much less disciplined kind of language that is in the newspaper. And of course, the language of a newspaper is very important. So I think that it's going to be interesting to see how, if this continues and if the paper continues to evolve in this way.
I read somewhere a while back that the lunatics at the editorial page never trusted Murdoch as a conservative. They thought he was much too much of an opportunist to be a real true believer.
I think that, you know, I have some friends on the editorial page, and I think that they don't see him as an ideologue. They see him as someone who's generally sympathetic to a sort of conservative standpoint, but he's not someone who is ideological. He's exactly, as you say, more of a pragmatist and an opportunist, although I think his sensibilities do lie on the to the right of the political spectrum.
But now he also, it seems, wants to kill the New York Times.
Indeed.
Why does he want to do that, and do you think he can do it?
He wants to do that for, I think, some personal reasons. He seems to have a lot of personal antipathy for Arthur Sulzberger and what that kind of old newspaper family kind of represents. But he also is such a predatory competitor. He's not the kind of executive who is like a Steve Jobs that invents something completely new that no one's ever seen before. What he's really able to do is to spot great competitive opportunities where he senses some kind of weakness that he can exploit. And he sees in the New York Times a weakness. And he sees this as, you know, it's a great paper that has a monopoly in New York, essentially, and advertisers that are very loyal to it. And so if what he can do is...
But also very dull in a lot of ways.
The New York Times?
Yeah.
Very dull? I mean, I guess so.
It's like the anti-Murdoch.
Well, it's not. It's exactly the kind of American newspaper that he sees as self-important and stodgy. He doesn't think that American newspapers are well written. He thinks British newspapers are much better written and sort of snappier. So in that, to that degree, I think so. Although I would say in the New York Times, I mean, they broke the Spitzer prostitute scandal. They've almost brought down the second governor of the state in David Paterson. Like, they're not shying away from stories that are pretty interesting.
Yeah, but the style is sober.
This
Spitzer story, I mean, that cries out
you could have
a little sensation.
Or you can leave something to the imagination.
Yeah,
but
the prominent use of socks in an illustration.
So what he wants to do with the New York Times is he sees them, I mean, of course, the New York Times is controlled by the Sulzberger family, which is not entirely unlike the Bancroft family, although there are big differences between those two. So they don't have an endless pool of money to draw from. They're now in hock to Carlos Slim. They have a big they have two big loans to Carlos Slim.
Like a 14% coupon they're paying.
It's sort of a usury kind of loan, but Murdoch has a lot more flexibility financially to battle the Times. And the thing that's sort of genius about him going after the Times is that he has so much more financial flexibility. And if he can get them to just focus on fighting the Journal, then that really takes their eye off the ball in a certain way. They've got to defend New York. They've got to defend their home turf. And he can sort of attack them in New York and still have a lot left over for other things. I mean, the danger, of course, is with additional coverage of New York, which is what Murdoch is doing right now, that he will somehow forget the other almost, you know, if the 1.5 million readers outside of New York that are reading the Journal for great financial and corporate coverage and the stories that you were talking about, whether it's like stories of society, business, all the kinds of things that you in the past have relied on the Journal for. So I think it's a little bit, he could win this battle and also, you know, he could kill the Journal to save the Journal in the way that he's pursuing things.
I've only got about 15 seconds left, but it's also a newspaper. So can it survive as a newspaper?
I think so. I think if there are two papers left in the country, it's going to be the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal.
I suppose we could do worse than that. All right. Thank you. I've been speaking with Sarah Ellison, who is the author of War at the Wall Street Journal, Inside the Struggle to Control America's Business Empire, just out from Houghton Mifflin. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this old classic from 10cc. Till next week. Bye. Street when your index is low.